You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Bonnie Christian, is a theological and political writer with a national following. She has columns and bylines at publications that include Time, CNN, Relevant, Politico, The Los Angeles Times, Renew, and The American Conservative. Bonnie is on the teaching team at her church, a Mennonite community, and is a graduate of Bethel Seminary with a Master of Arts in Christian Thought. She lives with her husband in St. Paul, Minnesota. Her new book is A Flexible Faith, Rethinking What It Means to Follow Jesus Today. Bonnie, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bonnie, I'm curious, what gave you the idea for this book and who you wrote it for?
You know, it was for a couple of reasons. I would say the first is for sort of a particular audience, which is to say, I'm sure you're familiar, and I'm guessing many of your audience are familiar with this idea of the nuns, people who are just dropping their religious affiliation altogether, and just maybe they're spiritual but not religious, but they're done with the church if they were ever in the church at all. And that group is particularly well represented among my generation, millennials. I was thinking about sort of that demographic and thinking about, like, well, what if people are leaving the church not because they don't like Jesus or because there's no sort of home for them in the church, but because they've only ever encountered maybe one branch of Christianity, and that's maybe a branch that they can't accept. I think that, you know, you hear the horror story in at least in evangelicalism, I did, of kids who grow up in church and then they go to college and they're exposed to, like, the evil atheist professor, and they hear about evolution and they abandon their faith. But you can believe in evolution and still be a Christian, right? And so if we're telling people there's only one way to be a Christian, and it's exactly what you grew up with, and everything else is wrong, and so if you don't agree with exactly everything you were taught, you need to just stop being a Christian. Well, they probably will stop being a Christian at some point as their ideas evolve and as they encounter different perspectives. And so I wanted to write a book to say, like, look, there's a lot of different ways to be a Christian. There's a lot of Christians who disagree on big issues like evolution or like how we do communion or what hell is like or how we should engage in politics. And disagreeing on these issues doesn't make you a heretic. It doesn't mean that you have to quit your faith. And so you should be aware of what's out there and aware of sort of these other traditions within Christianity. And so that was one reason. And then the second reason was sort of looking at the people who are not in that season of deconstruction, who are comfortable with their current church context, but maybe unfamiliar with these other traditions. And I think it becomes very difficult for us to work across denominational lines when we don't understand what other Christians believe, why they believe it, and how it relates to what we believe. We start to become very suspicious and distrustful of each other, and we start to suspect, you know, maybe they're not really Christians, even though they share all our core beliefs about, you know, the basic dogmas of faith, about who Jesus is, about his divinity, and that he's the sole source of salvation. And so I don't want to be mistaken. I don't want people to think that I'm saying these differences don't matter or that there's not truth or that there's not a right view on these questions. But that does not mean that we can't work with Christians who disagree and that we can't understand and appreciate and even learn from Christians who are from other traditions than we are.
In the beginning of the book, you give a quote. I think it's by Andy Stanley. And he says that millennials don't think of their Christian faith as a version of anything. They see it as definitive Christianity. So if it becomes ill-fitting for them, if they encounter information that makes them doubt that, then they must have to give up the faith completely. And I've noticed that just in my anecdotal conversations with people, people who are having doubts, people who left the faith, when I really get down to hearing from them what it is that they, what their problems are with it, a lot of times they're problems that I also have. It's funny. It never occurred to me that people would think that their version that they grew up with was the only version, and how blind a lot of people are to the spectrum of Christianity and also historical Christianity, the various things that Christians have believed throughout the history of the church.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are things that we might, in our, you know, fairly limited context of church, think are so strange or so radical, but it's actually like, you know, people were doing this for hundreds of years. This isn't some new unusual thing, and it's just our ignorance of church history that causes us to be like weirded out by it. But yeah, the Andy Stanley quote was so good, and coming upon it, it was one of those moments of like, yes, someone is thinking exactly what I'm thinking. And, you know, he's famous. Let me quote him. but I remember in high school being told, I think it was by like the guy who ran the youth group, such as it was at my church, that if you doubted sort of the very literal 6,000 years ago, 7-day creation story, then you were calling into question the truth of the whole Bible. And if you were doing that, you might as well just not be a Christian anymore. And I'm so glad that I didn't buy into that, because, you know, that is a pretty quick recipe to maybe not staying in the church for very long.
In the book, you take different subjects and you give what the different viewpoints are within Orthodox Christianity about those things. And then after each chapter, there's a Q&A that's kind of unrelated to the previous chapter, but a Q&A with someone from a stream of Christianity that probably most people aren't familiar with, which I love. So that's kind of the format of the book. I'm wondering how you decided which subjects you were going to tackle.
Yeah, so I looked at a number of other books, actually. Zondervan has a Counterpoints series, which sort of does what I did of presenting the competing perspectives on a given topic within Orthodox Christianity, but they do it at book length, and they have someone who, for a single topic, and they have someone who believes and advocates each perspective, explaining it, and then sometimes they're like in dialogue with each other at the end. So I looked at that series to sort of see what they covered. I also looked at the list in Greg Boyd and Paul Eddy's book, Across the Spectrum, which sort of does a similar thing, but they look just at positions within evangelicalism, sort of broadly understood, whereas my book also looks at mainline Protestantism and Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. So I looked at their list, and there are, I would say their list is close to mine. However, mine has more sort of lifestyle issues, if you will, things like engaging in politics, wealth and poverty is one that I believe they didn't address. And then I sort of just thought about, like, you know, what are sort of the big issues that you do, and again, this is anecdotally, as you mentioned, but you do hear people leaving the faith because this is something they just, you know, can't stick with what they were originally taught, and tried to make sure all of that was included.
I noticed that you really, I mean, this is one of the things I really appreciated about the book. You presented these views, and you didn't really come to any conclusions. You weren't saying, and this is the right one. Often, sometimes you say what your view is, and sometimes you don't. And it seems like that was something that was just really important to you.
Yeah, in about a third of the chapters, I think, I did present my view. And those were the chapters where it was something that I felt particularly strongly about. And so part of this comes from sort of my take on bias in journalism, which is that bias is to some degree inevitable because we're humans, we're not machines. And so better than trying to present sort of a false objectivity is to just be honest about where your bias is and say, like, look, this is my perspective. I'd rather you know what it is, and then you can read what I'm writing with that in mind, and, you know, sort of be on the lookout for, has my bias creeped in and made my, in my accounting of this unfair. And so for every chapter, for every topic, I, you know, obviously tried to be as fair as possible, tried to present the arguments, citing people who were theologians who were key in developing that perspective. But for those, about a third of the chapters where I did have a stronger opinion, I wanted to be upfront and say, like, look, this is where I land and this is why. And also to give readers just a little bit of an idea of who I am and where I'm coming from.
Well, I think one of the reasons I appreciate that method that you took was because churches are certainly really bad about this, but even seminaries will only present one viewpoint to their students. And like I said, churches do that all the time in really, I think, destructive ways. Only present one viewpoint as if it's the only one that exists or the only one that real, you know, quote unquote, real Christians believe. You know, I see people coming out of seminaries and I think, well, of course you believe what you believe because you were told that's the only thing to believe. And I'm not of the opinion that seminaries should just lay out the options and just say pick one. Like, I think that, you know, I think it's good that seminaries have viewpoints and even that professors who are teaching advocate for the position that they take. I really like that, and I think that's important. But I think what happens is people leave churches and people leave seminaries being really ignorant to the other viewpoints that are out there, and it really makes them have a weaker case for the opinions that they hold themselves.
It does. And this was something that I so appreciated about my own seminary, which was Bethel Seminary up here in Minnesota. They deliberately, and they say this in like their marketing materials, and it's part of why I applied there, but they deliberately cultivate an ironic approach, which is just to say, like, allowing space for disagreement and discussion and debate on issues that are not the essentials, not the core of the faith, on these sort of still very important, but lesser issues that I cover in the book. And I understand why churches and seminaries can tend to do what you described, to especially churches, to say, to just present the one viewpoint and, you know, this is the right viewpoint, this is what we believe. And certainly I think they should be presenting their viewpoint. But I would want to move, especially with the education of newer Christians or of young people, move towards saying, like, look, there are these other viewpoints. We think they're wrong, but they're not heretical. So here's a fair look at them, and here's a fair look at what we believe, and here's why we think you should agree with us on this. But, you know, if you end up with one of these other views, it doesn't mean you're not a Christian.
Yeah, and that's so important because I think what the end product winds up being when we say this is the one viewpoint is we really just increase tribalism and create this us versus them mentality and saying, like, hey, we're all in the family and here's the different viewpoints in there. You know, we take this one, it's not that one, but that's okay.
Yeah, one example that I like to cite in thinking about this. I did not grow up as an Anabaptist or a Mennonite, but I am in a Mennonite community now. And I think that the Mennonites, of course, are a historic peace church, very much committed to nonviolence. And that is historically well represented in the church, but it has always been the minority viewpoint since about, you know, 300 or 400 AD. And certainly since, you know, Mennonites specifically have come to be, commitment to nonviolence has been the minority as compared to people who support just war theory or even holy war. But you don't find, and part of this is because it's just been so long, I think, since the Anabaptists came to be, since the Mennonites came to be, you don't really find people saying, like, oh, if you disagree with me on violence, you're not a Christian, right? Like, the pacifists are not out here saying, like, oh, you just war theory people are heretics, and the just war theory people are not saying, oh, you pacifists are heretics. And that's it's a big issue, right? Like, this is about, is it okay to kill people with violence? Like, yeah, this is not a small issue. And yet with time, we've learned to say, like, yes, we disagree on this. Yes, it's important, but we're not going to try to kick out of the faith over this.
You know, I think that's also reminds me of why it's so important, especially if when we take the majority view within Christianity, to be merciful, especially to those in the minority view. It's easier to do it if you're in the minority, to be merciful to the majority. I think, I can't remember who I was talking to. It may have been Nijay Gupta. He's a professor in Oregon. He was saying that in places where Christianity is the minority, Christians will find ways to seek commonalities with the majority religion there. But where, when it's the opposite, Christians will find ways to contrast their Christianity with other religions to show how it's different. And I think the same way happens within Christianity when, if we have the majority opinion within Christianity, we find ways to kind of like, for that viewpoint to domineer the others, to, you know, to seek to look at our differences rather than the commonalities. And I think that's so important, to be merciful to those who have that minority view within Christianity. And I know being on both sides of that, where it's a lot of my beliefs are majority and a lot of them are minority, where it really, being on the short end of that really produces kind of a mercy and a grace within me for those that I disagree with.
I think that's absolutely right and so necessary. And it's difficult because we want to be right about everything. And obviously, we all believe that we're right about everything. I mean, this is how the human mind works, because if you came to think you were wrong about something, you would change your mind on that. And then once again, you'd be right about everything. And so when we're all right about everything, it is difficult to have that mercy, to have grace for people that we think are wrong. And so I do think it helps to be able to say, there's a difference between saying you're wrong and you're a heretic. And we need to make that distinction far better than we have been. I was going to say in recent years, but really throughout church history, the practice of farewelling people did not start with Twitter. And I'm sure you're familiar with Martin Luther. His, even as much as he was in the minority and breaking away from Rome, by the time that he sort of got established and had his church, he's writing these like vicious polemics against people who disagreed with him theologically. It's very rough. It makes all of our disagreements just look so polite and kind.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. I mean, as ugly as it can get now, I mean, the writing that you're talking about, and also the people that were just straight up executed for having minority beliefs. Yeah, good to hold in a historical perspective. I was just going to ask how you chose who and what communities to choose to do the Q&A in every other chapter.
Sure. That was super interesting and one of really the most enjoyable parts of writing the book. So I did a couple things. First, I sort of made my own list of like, who would I have for this? And my criteria, and this is inevitably fuzzy, but my criteria was that it would be someone who was living their faith in a unique way, as opposed to someone who just represented a certain belief. And so like the line between that is not clear. And there are probably a couple where you could make the case of like, oh, this is closer to belief. But it's why, for example, like I didn't include, say, meet a Calvinist, because that's a belief. It's not so much like the lifestyle sort of thing. So I made my own list. And then I polled the readers of my blog to see what they'd be interested in. Then I also just talked to some, you know, various friends who came from different traditions, different theological backgrounds than I did. Amish people were always the first thing that came up with everyone I talked to. It'd be like, oh, you've got to get an Amish person. I think sort of just because, you know, it's not like you're going to meet an Amish person on Twitter, whereas these other people you could conceivably encounter them online or something. So that came up a lot. And then sort of more Pentecostal, charismatic traditions were a frequent suggestion. And then monastics, that was a frequent point of interest as well. So I did end up speaking with a Benedictine nun, and then also an Eastern Orthodox woman who's in a monastic community in California, I believe. And, you know, plenty of others as well. A big one for me was getting in a Native American follower of Jesus, and Randy Woodley, who's written a number of books, was kind enough to talk with me for that. So that one I was very excited about. The one where I spoke with a member of the Bruderhof communities, which are these, like, they're common purse communities, mostly in like upstate New York. But they're like traditional Anabaptists in many ways, but they use the internet, they use technology. It's a real interesting situation. And I really enjoyed speaking with her a lot, but I could highlight like all of them. So I should not keep going on this.
I had one of the members of the Bruderhof community on the show a while back. They had, one of them had edited a book. I think it was called The Community. I can't remember, but it was like an essay book and it was really wonderful. So I really enjoyed, learning about them a little bit more. I think it's interesting. It seems like, and perhaps this is just anecdotal and not a broader trend, but I suspect that it is, that within Christianity, there's a real interest in streams of Anabaptism and then also streams of monastic life. I suspect it's just something about where we are right now in society that makes people really interested in those kind of communities.
Yeah, and I think the aspect of community is the single, it's the commonality between those two, and I think it's probably the single biggest draw in that interest. As I mentioned, I'm in a Mennonite church, and honestly, anytime anyone asks me about our congregation, like, community is always the first thing that springs to mind. It was the thing that, like, within the first Sunday that we were there, we were like, oh, this is where we're going to be because of this community. My experience of Anabaptist churches is limited to precisely this one, but the priority on community and on having community that's more substantial, more important and more demanding of your life than many traditions is something that's unique, and I think something that people want and long for and that can be difficult to find. I regularly will see, like, on social media posts of someone who has moved to a new city and they just don't have any idea how to make new friends because they're adults and it's not like college where you're sort of just thrown together with people. And I always want to be like, just go find an Anabaptist church. You will have friends. They will be in your life. You will be in their lives. You will be having potlucks and you will be hanging out. Because they do put such an emphasis on community. And of course, monasticism is more structured and more of a full-time commitment to that. But I'm guessing that a lot of the interest in that stems from that same sort of loneliness and longing to be with people in a way that we often are not.
I think part of that also is maybe a reaction to the kind of church where everybody, they go for this gathering, this service, and leave, but never really interact much with the people around them, and certainly never really experience real community. And so those Anabaptist streams, those monastic streams, have an answer to that, a response to that.
Yeah, and those sort of churches are so common, and especially, and I've been in them, and especially if you're introverted, as I am, yeah. It's so easy to sort of like slip in, slip out. You heard the Bible, so that was church, right? but I mean, it becomes functionally the same as listening to a sermon podcast at home by yourself. And it really doesn't get at any of the idea, the vision of church and the impact, the spiritual impact of church that the New Testament envisions, certainly, and that I think we just as humans need to have that sort of engagement and that sort of group of people who are not willing to let you slip in and slip out and fade into the background, because they, you know, are going to invite you over to things and expect you to do things for them, when make them a dish when they're having a baby. Like that sense of expectation and obligation, I think people both want it and also want to shy away from it. And it's necessary, though, to force ourselves to say, no, I am in, and I am going to accept this and be a meaningful and participatory member of this community, because that is part of what it means to follow Jesus.
You mentioned some of the interviews. I don't know if you call them interviews, but the chapters with the Q&A. You mentioned some of them that stood out to you. I wonder if there were any that were surprising to you that you learned the most from.
The Benedictine nun whom I mentioned, that was an interesting one. And partly, and this is not in the book, but because she left, she's an older woman. I don't know exactly how old, but she's been doing this, you know, for several decades. And she left me a voicemail that I still have saved on my phone, which is maybe a little weird because it's been like a year and a half now. But she left me a voicemail thanking me for the Q&A, because it had provided an opportunity for her to really reflect on what she'd been doing for all these years and to sort of think about it in the big picture. And so in that context, I loved reading her responses, and like as she's assessing this, you know, huge life of community and service and trying to formulate it in this very brief space that I've given her. I was also, I think, really intrigued by the interview with the woman in Messianic Judaism, mainly because I didn't know much about it. When I was growing up, I had a friend who, her family was not ethnically Jewish, nor had they ever been like in the religion of Judaism. So I don't know why they were in a Messianic Jewish church exactly.
Okay.
But they were. And I haven't seen them in years. That was my only exposure to it. And I just remember wondering, like, I'm not sure why you do this. And so it was super fascinating to talk to someone who actually was raised in Judaism and did convert to following Jesus as an adult. To hear her responses and to see, you know, what remains important to her in terms of like staying connected to how she grew up, but also how that's changed things for her as she has become a Christian and yet maintained those contexts to her background.
I think you mentioned in the book that you grew up Baptist. Is that right?
Mostly. Actually, after I sent my mother a promotional copy of the book for her to read it for the first time, she texted me, "We mostly did not go to Baptist churches." What I meant by that was that, like, that was the one, the single most represented denomination. We also went to a lot of non-denominational and Bible churches. But functionally, they were basically Baptist, just without the like organizational structure.
Yeah, that's so funny. I grew up Baptist too, and anytime I visited like a non-denominational church, I just thought I cannot tell the difference between my Baptist church and these churches at all.
It's close.
Very, very close. So I wonder if there was a time in your life where you felt like the faith that you had grown up with was ill-fitting and you had to let go of some things and embrace some new things.
Yes and no. And I sort of struggle to answer this in that I didn't have what you could call a crisis of faith, but that's not because I didn't have to rethink some things or I didn't end up changing my mind on some things. It's really more about like aspects of my personality for which I really can't take any credit because it just is. And this mostly happened in maybe the final year of college through the first few years after that, which is a little bit later, I think, than it happens for many people. And so my response to running into these questions was sort of like, well, I'm going to research this and take my time to figure it out. Because that's my response to questions on everything, is I'm going to read a lot of books on it and do some internets. So it never really hit a point. There was deconstruction and there was rebuilding, but it never really hit a point that could be called crisis. I don't think I ever really had a foot out the door. I was sort of able and to be comfortable in, like, I'm doing this research. I'll reach a conclusion. For right now, I'm fine with, you know, staying in church and continuing doing what I'm doing. But again, that's really much more about just like my personality and where my brain goes in situations like that. And so for me, some of the big issues that came up are actually a lot of the issues that are the chapters where I gave my perspective in the book. Hell was one of them. Theories of the Atonement was a big one. Roles of women was certainly important as I was, you know, getting into writing about theology as a woman, things that potentially men could read and be led by. Those are probably the three biggest. There is a fourth. The issue of peace and violence, and that was a major point that led me towards Anabaptism. So it did happen. It maybe was not as exciting as big of a, it didn't feel like as big of a change when it was happening as I suspect it does for many people. And so that, looking back on that, was also part of why I was interested in writing A Flexible Faith, because I was thinking like, okay, many people don't have the inclination or the time to do sort of the research that I did when they run across these questions. Or maybe they want to do it, but they don't know where to begin. And so I wanted to say like, all right, you've had these questions, you've had this time of deconstruction, like here's a book that will, it's not going to go in depth on everything, but it's going to give you a good foundation to start rebuilding, and it's going to give you references to read more on the things that are still really troubling you, to dig deeper into the perspective that intrigue you. And so here's like a guide to get you started as this experience happens to you and you're maybe ready to re-engage with the church and figure out if there's a new context within Christianity that could be a good fit for where you are now.
Well, Bonnie, thank you so much. And you had months ago asked me to write a blurb for the book. And after I read the sample chapter that you sent, I was so honored that you had asked me, and just honored to be able to support this fantastic book. So I was so honored to do that. And I'm just really in love with the book and really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk about it.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much. And, you know, I'm not a big podcast person. I'm not a big radio person either, but I do listen to Seminary Dropout. Not every episode, but probably more than any other podcast. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at Beard on a Bike. That's at Beard on a Bike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,